So, as I said, the title I gave to this talk is Preparing for a New Year, Setting Our Intentions. Pretty obvious thing to talk about this time of year. Here we are. It's 2 days before New Year's. In our culture, our Western culture, New Year's resolutions are a fairly common aspect of what people do at this time of year. And I'll talk more about that later. But I want to talk more at this point first about the word intention itself. This is a topic. The topic of intention is something that Buddha put enormous emphasis on. When you think about Eightfold Path, right understanding, and then right intention, right there, right the second step. We've somehow come to right understanding, or at least the beginnings of right understanding, where we are waking up to the fact that things aren't working out as much as we would like them to. We see the central problems of having a human existence. We see that our mind and our habits of mind are, relatively speaking, uncontrolled. And it's that understanding. And also the understanding that, and here's this person called, the people called the Buddha, who did something about this. He actually learned how to work skillfully with the mind so that he wouldn't be run over by it on a regular basis. He learned how to tame the mind. He learned how to, what he called, cross the flood. The flood is an image meaning that constant flow of stuff that keeps arising in our mind, one thing after another. If you really look at the mind, which you is part of what we do when we practice, we see how endless the flow of thoughts and emotions and rememberings and things, stuff, just flows on through the mind. This is like a flood. And this practice is about learning how to cross the flood. It's a famous image that's used all through the sutta, and several of the Buddha's talks have that image in it. And so what can we do? How do we do something about crossing this flood? And primarily what we do is we set our intentions. Which is, we have right understanding, we know we have to do something. So now we have to set our intention to actually do this. Here's what we're going to do. That's what setting intentions is all about. It's sort of setting a firm course. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. I understand that how my mind operates now, it isn't perfect, isn't working that well sometimes. I understand that these teachings seem to point me towards the direction where I am not sort of overwhelmed by this flood all the time. And so then I set the intention. I have right intention to do something. Now, intention by itself, by the way, remember, is very neutral. I could very easily form a firm intention to sleep in late every morning and stay up every night drinking beer. This would be an intention, right? Not, but wouldn't be what I'd call a wholesome intention. And so what we have to do is we have to actually look at these intentions and see that they're wholesome, that they're skillful. The word right, we often, when you hear the Eight Noble the Eightfold Path to hear the word right. I've never been real happy with that word. It has sort of right, wrong, sort of finger wagging energy to it. I prefer skillful and wholesome, I think, are much better words. So we want our intentions to be skillful, to be wholesome. And I want to talk a little bit more about that, but I want to come back to the word intention in and of itself a little bit more. Another thing the Buddha points out about intention in many, many places in the teaching is that every act of body, speech, and mind, every conscious act of body, speech, and mind is preceded by intention. Like if I'm going to lift my arm up, before I lift my arm up, I have to have the intention to lift it up, and then I have the intention to bring it back down. There's always in this mental formation of intention has to be there before anything ever happens. And so on one level, what we have to do is somehow make sure that our intentions lead toward the wholesome, right? Well, if I can see that intention arise, if I can be truly mindful, if I can really pay attention to the arising of intention, then I always have the choice whether or not to actually do that. I can say, I can see that intention to, you know, whack that person. Well, probably not a good idea. I'm not going to do that. Or to eat that fifth piece of chocolate cake today, or whatever it is. I mean, I'm being trivial here, but just to get my point across. If intention is a mental formation that always is there. So if you're interested in exploring intention in this way, see if you can, as you're sitting, you know, we're sitting still, trying to be still, and then an intention arises to move. It could be because we're uncomfortable. It could be because, you know, our nose itches and we want to scratch our nose. But before we do any of those motions, physical motions, we have the intention to do that has to arise. And if I see that intention arise, if I can be mindful of that intention arising, then I can choose not to scratch my nose, or not to move, or to move, but move very mindfully perhaps because I'm in pain. But the intention allows me to have choice. And also being able to, on this physical level, by seeing the intention to move, I can choose not to and stay still, stillness being an important part of the practice. Actually being able to sit still for longer and longer periods of time really deepens your practice over time. So just by exploring intention in this purely physical way in your sitting practice, noting intention before as it arises, and then consciously choosing whether or not to follow through with that intention to move in that way, can be very sort of interesting place to play with and get some deeper understanding of intention itself. The other interesting thing the Buddha says about intention is that all for karma to accrue to an action, there has to be intention first. So, for instance, I'm at some party. You know, this time of year normally would be at parties, not so much this year, but and I'm holding a drink and I'm just sort of chatting with someone and I have my drink in my hand, you know, my juice, of course, and someone bumps my arm and I spill my juice on the next person. There's no intention there. So there's no karmic result. Even though I got juice all over this person, there was no intention. So that has no karmic fruit. I mean, other than, you know, maybe I'll pay to get their pants dry clean, but, you know, that's a separate issue. But the actual act itself is not an act of intention. So it's only acts of intention that create karma that we then have to deal with later on. So being able to see our intention also allows us to sort of, in a sense, have some control over what karmic results we're going to have to deal with later in our lives or in the next life, perhaps. So intentional acts are the seed for everything else. Here's a famous quote from the Buddha. From intention springs the deed. From the deed springs the habit. From the habit grows the character. From the character develops destiny. So by learning to see our intentions, by to skillfully start working with intention and then making the choices towards the wholesome, towards the skillful, away from the unwholesome, the unskillful, this shifts how we are in the world. This starts to actually change us. So intention becomes this really important aspect of the teaching in this way, because it's central to the process. And remember that intention can also be, like I said, on this sort of micro level of moving a limb, but it's also like this, it can be on sort of like the macro, on the high level of like, oh, I have to set the intention to actually work towards enlightenment. That's an intention we set. Without that intention, why are we practicing? I want to actually read something here. This is from Jack Kornfield's book, A Wise Heart, about this sort of large intention. So this is in Jack's words. This is from the book, The Wise Heart. Long-term intention is called dedication. In the forest monastery, we would gather before dawn in the candlelight darkness, and the monks would begin the sonorous morning chant to dedicate our day. The chants reminded us that the path to awakening is possible when we dedicate ourselves to a noble way of life. We would dedicate ourselves to use the support we received from the awakening of compassion for the awakening of compassion for all beings. Setting a long-term intention is like setting the compass of our heart. No matter how rough the storms, how difficult the terrain, even if we have to backtrack around obstacles, our direction is clear. The fruits of dedication are visible in the best of human endeavors. We can see them in wise people that we encounter. At times, our dedications are practical, to learn to play the piano well, to build a thriving business, to build and plant a beautiful garden. But there are overarching dedications as well. We might dedicate our life to prayer, commit ourselves to unwavering truthfulness, or to work for world peace. These overarching dedications set the compass of our life, regardless of the outer conditions. They give us direction and meaning. So one of those overarching things would be to set a firm intention, to dedicate ourselves to this practice. Or at this time of year, we might think of this as rededicating ourselves to this practice. Because, I mean, you're all here on a Thursday night. You could be doing lots of other things. So obviously, you have some dedication to the practice or you wouldn't be here. So maybe we should think of this as rededication. Beginning anew, as David might say. There's another quote from the Buddha I also want to talk about here, which I think is very relevant to this topic. This is from the Dhammapada, verse 290 from the Dhammapada. If you see a greater happiness that comes from forsaking a lesser happiness, be willing to forsake the lesser happiness for the sake of the greater one. This is, I think, like really clear instruction. We see the greater happiness. We see the greater happiness of what arises if we really practice the Dharma. I'm just, if you really look at people who are deeply, deeply practiced, they all seem so happy. I mean, I've hung out with a few people who've been practicing for a very long time, very deeply. And the energy in the room, just hanging out with them, is palpable. You feel their happiness. This is why people like the Dalai Lama can get 20,000 people to go to a hockey arena just to hear him speak. Because he exudes this happiness. He radiates it. It's because he has forsaken the lesser happinesses for the greater happiness. This is part of what setting intention means. It means, oh, if I'm going to really dedicate myself to this practice, you know, maybe instead of going on that beach vacation next year, I'm going to go do a long retreat. That's giving up the lesser happiness for the greater happiness. And we have to start looking at our whole life, looking at all the choices we make and seeing what direction those choices are leading us towards. And this is, we do this quite intentionally. We look and say, is this something, do I have to give up this lesser happiness for this greater happiness? And inevitably, by the way, the nature of this practice means the answer is always going to be yes. As you go deeper into this practice, things that you used to do that were like the fun things, sometimes they just start to fall away. That's been my experience anyway. It's just they don't seem so important or necessary anymore. They're lesser happy. It's not that going to the beach for a week doesn't make me happy. I used to love going to the beach, you know, go with the kids and play in the sand and, you know, body surf and do all those things you do when you go to the beach, right? It just doesn't move me anymore. It's not like, oh, I have to go do that. It's like, no, I'd rather go sit for a week. And it's just these choices on a larger level like that and on much smaller levels sometimes. You know, we have to sort of start making those choices. So we have to form wholesome intentions. But, yeah, you know, there's always a couple of buts, right? One of them is, there's this famous saying in our culture that says, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. It's fine to make intention, to form, to be sort of resolute. Yes, I'm going to do this. But we have to be careful. We have to be careful not to sort of overdo it, to what Joseph Goldstein calls to strive too much. And this is from his book, Insight Meditation. And when he talks about this issue of being careful with your intentions. You can also reflect on what first awakened your interest in your own journey of understanding. Was it some deep experience of personal suffering? Was it compassion for the suffering of others? Was it some inner groping for meaning or purpose in your life? Sometimes we lose touch with what first inspired us. It can help us to reconnect to that initial interest and inspiration. Doing so can rekindle the fire of effort, of passion for this amazing path of waking up and becoming free. So this is the idea of rededicating ourselves to our intentions. Is one very skillful thing to do is just to go back to that original intention. way back then, whenever it was, whether it was a week ago or 50 years ago, it doesn't make any difference. There was an original spark, something that said, yeah, this is what I want to do. And remember that. And often just remembering that will be give you the impetus to rededicate yourself to the practice. Without the five effort, nothing happens. We simply live out and act out all the old habit patterns of our conditioning. It is extremely difficult to step outside these habits, to discern in a clear, fresh way what is actually occurring and make choices based on wisdom rather than on reactive conditioning. But effort alone is not enough. Valuable as this quality is, it can also lead us astray if it is overdeveloped. We can become attached to the goal of enlightenment and become very ambitious with a kind of spiritual competitiveness or a strong self-judgment about our progress. We can strive and strain with an excessive energy that can become desperation. Wanting something to happen right now gets in the way of clear seeing. It leads to frustration, disappointment, and even despair. Recognizing, often through painful personal experience, the difficulties that come from such a striving, expecting mind, many people discard the notion of goal altogether. This is also a mistake. If we abandon the sense of goal and become attached to the idea that practice is simply becoming aware and mindful in the moment, without any sense of destination, development, or deepening realization, then we lose a source of tremendous energy and inspiration. The critical balance we need to discover in meditation practice, and indeed in all aspects of our life, is the equipoise between effort and surrender. On the surface, these two qualities seem to contradict each other. How can we make effort, be purposeful, and at the same time surrender to what is happening, to the natural unfolding of our experience? Grasping this paradox is a decisive turning point in coming to understand the whole spiritual journey. Surrender does not mean passive resignation. Let me repeat that. Surrender does not mean passive resignation. Rather, it means surrender to the Dharma, to the truth of the moment's experience. Such acceptance enables us to make effort to arouse energy, but without agitation or grasping. We have a sense of spiritual urgency, while at the same time we soften and surrender to just what is happening in this moment, and then this, and then the next. So it's really important we understand what he's talking about here. There's this balance. If we push too hard, the practice just becomes grim. If we sort of have this goal and then it's like, I'm going to get there. I'm going to be realized this year, no matter what. Yes, sir, I'm going to do it. And on some level, it's sort of wholesome. And on another level, it's very dangerous because it gets us caught up in striving. In pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. At the same time, to have no goal at all, to think that somehow the practice is all there is, it's just the practice itself, and it's just like, well, we do the practice and nothing, who cares? Doesn't work either. We have to constantly remember that the reason we practice is to move, perhaps very slowly, very step by step towards enlightenment. If we lose that sight of that, then the practice becomes pretty meaningless. We have to keep remembering where we're headed, what this practice is about. That's really important that we never let go of that understanding. So I came across another interesting quote of the Buddha I want to share when I was preparing for this talk. Now we're moving more towards the idea of resolve, of setting resolutions. And this is the Buddha talking about resolve. A person has four grounds for resolve. to resolve on wisdom, on truth, on relinquishment, and on calm. So if we're going to make resolutions, what the Buddha is saying is one of these four, or maybe even more than one of these four grounds for resolve, should be at the forefront of our thoughts as we make those resolutions. So let's look at these each. So we could, what does it mean to take a resolve on wisdom? I remember wisdom is sort of a code word for understanding impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. So does this resolution I'm taking, this firm intention I'm setting, lead me towards a better understanding of these three great problems of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self? It's important to consider this as you make the resolution. So, which makes the resolution process somewhat less trivial, perhaps. There's nothing wrong with, you know, resolving to eat less chocolate, only once a week. This might be a useful thing to do. In my case, it would be a very useful thing to do. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about resolution in the context of spiritual life, in the context of practice. So we can take a resolve on wisdom. Then the next one on the list, he said, we can resolve on truth. So this has sort of two meanings, I think. One is if we take a resolution on truth, we're living in a way that is always truthful, which means a lot more than just not telling fibs, right? It means being totally transparent and honest with others. Being careful not to turn this into a way to sort of become a gossip, which is how some people turn this particular idea around. Everybody should know this, blah, blah, blah. But it's like being open and acting in such a way that you're never going to have to tell an untruth about what you just did or feel like you need to. Or feel like, this has to be kept secret, but this, which is where our mind often goes about delicate things in our lives, perhaps. And we have to sort of let that go. We have to live in this sort of transparent way where we're open and we have nothing to hide. I like that expression, nothing to hide. So that's one level of truthfulness. The other level is we have to be honest with ourselves. We often aren't honest with ourselves. We fool ourselves into thinking, well, we're doing okay, or whatever words you might use. That's okay. Blah, blah, blah. Being honest with ourselves gives us a firm basis on which to then decide what to do. If we're not honest with ourselves, how can we make decisions in the world that are skillful? Because they're based on false premises. Difficult to do. Okay. Then he says, you can make a resolve on relinquishment. Relinquishment. What a great word, eh? Another word you'll see in the sutta that means the same thing is effacement. Basically, both these words mean giving things up. We have to inevitably, as we go deeper into this practice, give things up. Just, if nothing else, because this practice, as we go deeper into it and we spend more time and more time and more time, in sitting practice, in study, in service, you know, however, what form this practice takes. We're not going to have enough time to do all those other things we do now. We're going to run out of time, literally. And so we have to relinquish some of these things. Also, we have to relinquish things that we see with right understanding aren't wholesome, aren't useful. Staying up late watching movies is a wonderful thing to do. But if I do it all the time, then I'm not going to be able to get up early to practice. So maybe I have to, you know, my friends say, oh, let's all go to this movie or this party or this whatever. And we get to say, no, I need to go to bed at the right time so I can get up and practice, do my regular daily practice. I have to relinquish that thing that was seemed so attractive. And once again, you know, that might seem like a trivial idea, but it's like if we start looking at our lives, we start seeing all the ways we don't use our time wisely. We don't use our time directed towards the practice enough. And I'm not saying your life becomes totally just practice. I'm not suggesting anyone here should take ropes. That would be improper for me to suggest that because I would make a terrible monk myself. So I'm not going to suggest to anybody else do that either. But we have to, it's like how, where's the line we draw with those sorts of things? So it's basically we're giving up those things that are no longer necessary in our lives. It also means giving up things. You know, think of all the stuff we have and all the energy we put into maintaining it, taking care of it, paying for it. And all that time and energy we're spending could be spent more skillfully if we just decided we don't need so much stuff. And so this is like relinquishment is another way of saying living simply, trying to consciously choose not to get caught up in the Western culture that says, you know, I had a student who had this great t-shirt she used to wear that said, the person with the most stuff when they die wins. That's not what we want to go. That's not where we want to go anymore. We want to let go of that idea that we need lots of stuff. We're all householders, right? So we do need a roof over our heads and we need meals and you got to pay our insurance and our car payments and almost, you know, all that stuff we have to do. But we have to very consciously choose not to overdo it. Once again, and this is a great time of year to sort of look at all the stuff you have and all the stuff you're maybe saving up for or planning to get or and going, do I really need all that stuff? That's relinquishment. That's what the meaning of relinquishment. And we all need stuff. You know, I'm a carpenter and I have tools are like, oh my God. Oh, you know, I have to be very careful when I walk through places like Home Depot and McGuckin's Hardware. I walk by the tool department and I have to put on blinkers and walk through really quickly so I don't go, oh, there's another one. You know, it's like it's so easy to get caught up in wanting that new and wonderful thing. So that's, we have to think in terms of relinquishment. That's what he's meaning. That's what he's talking about here. And then the last thing he suggests we can resolve on is calm. What an interesting thing to make a resolve about. To put calmness, stillness, more into the center of our lives. To make a resolve that leads towards more calm and stillness. That takes me away from some of the chaos in my life, perhaps. Or some of the chaos that all of us in our lives experience. Going towards calm. It's, and we all get knocked away out of calm in our own ways. We all have different ways of doing that. I just can't watch, for instance, I'm just for me, this is, once again, this may seem trivial. I can't watch a violent movie anymore. You know, even though I used to love watching, you know, sort of those sort of like chase scenes and all that sort of stuff that goes on, I just can't do it anymore because I just can't deal with the energy that they create in my mind and body. So I just stopped watching them. Totally. I haven't watched anything like that in a long, long time. Because they just don't lead towards calm. They lead towards the opposite of calm. Once again, we can all look at these things ourselves and choose which ones make sense for us in our lives. But these are the things that the Buddha consciously says we should resolve on. Wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and calm. So this is what I'm sort of at the end of what I want to say about what the Buddha said and what the teachings say. And I want to talk now more about the actual process. I mean, here we are. Maybe we're actually thinking of taking New Year's resolutions, forming some resolutions. And there are there's a sort of an interesting way to do this. That my original teacher, Swami Vishnudevananda, taught many years ago. I learned this many years ago from him, and I have applied it from time to time in my life and found it to be very helpful in terms of the process of forming resolutions and then sticking with them. And there's sort of there's a list of things you want to think about besides what I've talked about. If you're forming a resolution, be specific as possible. So don't have a resolution, I'm going to meditate more. Because that's not specific enough. What does more mean, for instance? But on the other hand, if you're sort of like, well, right now I meditate every day, every morning or every afternoon, whenever your normal daily meditation time is, I meditate every day for 20 minutes. Well, maybe you make a resolution, say, I'm going to meditate every day, but now it's going to be for 25 minutes or 30 minutes. So you're upping the ante, but you're being very specific. You're not sort of, because we can say, oh, more means, you know, but once we get very specific, then it's harder to wiggle out of it later, which is what we often do with our resolutions, right? We form the resolution and then by February 1st, we're saying, oh, I didn't really mean that. But if I actually have this specific, make it as specific as possible, then it's harder for me to mentally wiggle out of these things. Second thing to do, and this I found extremely useful, was to write my resolutions down. Actually write down a list. This is what I resolved to do. Once again, being very specific. So maybe it's more than one, maybe it's three or four things on that list. Who knows? Everybody's list is going to be different because it's based on you and what you see will lead you towards more wisdom, calm, truth, and relinquishment. But we actually write it down. Writing things down makes them realer. It also means if we go back and look at that list, in February, we can't go, oh, I didn't mean that, because you wrote it down. There it is in black and white, right there on this piece of paper. You can no longer deny to yourself, which is what we do with resolutions. We often try and blow them off. So you can even make what you write down look like a contract. You know, I, Barry Gillespie, this day of, you know, December 30th, 2020, form the resolve to blah, 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 and then sign it. Like make it really official and date it. Maybe even if you're into this, then get someone to witness it, Boy, now you're really, you've revealed resolutions to someone else and they've witnessed it. Now you're really stuck, right? Now you really have to follow through. It just makes it more real, more powerful. It isn't this vague sort of set of ideas about maybe I should blah, blah, blah. These aren't intentions that paving the road to hell anymore. These are real things I've decided to do. I've written them down and I've sort of signed, sealed, and delivered. This is now it has a much stronger reality in our lives when it's done this way. Then another thing you might like to do is have a daily or a weekly period where you check in, gee, how am I doing here? You know, like every day or once a week you go, did I really didn't meditate every day this week for 25 or whatever the period of time was? You know, actually, you know, some people actually keep a little, like almost like a diary. You know, some of you should have done that. We should call it a spiritual diary. But we just kept track of, you know, yep, meditated today. Yep, did, yep, tick, tick, tick. It's a way, once again, of just like, it's not like keeping score. It's not the right word, but it's like keeping us honest. Yeah, I really followed through with this plan. If you actually, you know, keep track of how you're doing based on what you wrote down in that document, it's often quite interesting. And now we get to the important things. It's important that you make resolutions that are going to be hard, but not too hard. Has to push your edge a little bit. You know? So if you're, like I said, if you're meditating every day for 30 minutes, it's probably, you know, to say, okay, now I'm going to meditate every day for 40 minutes. That's a lot. For some people, that's a big step. And that might be just the right amount. Yeah. 32 minutes instead of 30 minutes, not going to make any difference. But 40 minutes, now that's like you've just added 33% to your daily meditation. That's a lot. But saying, I've been meditating every day for half an hour. Now I'm going to do an hour. Might be too much. That might turn into what Joseph called striving. Pushing too hard. You don't want to set yourself up with a set of resolutions that are going to be so difficult that you inevitably fail. Because then you'll just get really discouraged. But you don't want to set up a set of resolutions that are so easy, you're inevitably going to always succeed. Because then you didn't set them quite hard enough. So there's this fine balance between not too hard, not too easy, where we find this is more. This is going to make me work harder. This is moving me towards more wisdom, more truth, more relinquishment, more calm, without setting myself up for a big fall. And here's the last of the buts, and it's inevitably, you're going to mess up. You're going to miss something. You're not going to quite keep the resolutions perfectly. If you're keeping them perfectly all the time, like I said, you probably didn't set them that strong. You know, I could take resolutions, I'm never going to go to a bar and get drunk again. Well, that would be a great resolution because I could always keep it. You know, since I haven't been to a bar in 30 years or so. I mean, you know, so it's like, it would be real easy for me to keep that resolution. So it's not like it has to be something I actually have to work at. And it pushes my edge enough that I feel like, wow, this is okay. But no matter how superhuman you think you are, you're going to fail. There's going to be times when you just it doesn't work. You know, life's going to get in the way. You know, you had this plan to meditate every morning for half an hour, and then you get a phone call from your sister who's sick and you have to catch a plane and go see her, and you don't meditate that morning. And maybe while you're visiting your sister and you're busy taking care of her, you just get thrown out of your practice. Then the danger here is like, oh, well, that's it. I'm finished with this set of results. Next year, I'll try again, right? No, just start again. That's the beauty of this practice and of resolutions. You know, resolutions, number one, don't have to be just once a year. You know, this is the traditional time of year because that's what our culture does, right? But you can reset your resolutions anytime. You know, once a week, maybe you have to reset your resolutions because you're not quite hanging in there yet. In fact, sometimes you set your resolutions and then a month, you've been trying to keep them for a month or two, and you've been checking your progress, and you see that every week you're not quite making it. Maybe it's time to tone them down a little bit. Maybe your original plan was a bit too much. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with changing, making a new contract. Sorry, this contract was a bit too tough. I want to reset my contract. Thank you very much. And have resolutions that are more likely that you're going to keep, that are still going to push you, that are more than you were doing before, but are doable most of the time. Then that's the right balance. So this is the idea of setting New Year's resolutions. I want to review this very quickly. Be very specific. Write them down if that helps. I found for me, when I was really into this practice, I would write them down. It really did help. Regularly check your progress and make sure that whatever the resolutions you choose aren't too easy, but not too hard so that you always fail. Because our human nature doesn't, if we fail every week after week, then pretty soon I'll give this up. So it's got to be enough that we can do it most of the time. And then sometimes things are going to just set astray. You're going to have one of those mornings where you wake up and you go, oh God, go sit on that cushion. You got to be kidding. You know, we all have days like that, right? Where it's just a real struggle to practice. Because we're human beings. And we have to understand that too. And the beauty of this is a way, this actual setting of intention by forming resolutions is a way to literally take sort of more control of our practice life. We set these goals that are clearly written down, and then we do our best to actually follow them. Understanding that sometimes we have to reset and understanding that that's perfectly okay that we have to reset sometimes. So that's all I have to say. I'm now sort of going to, as we always do at this point, throw the floor open. Remember that with this number of people, we can't all sort of just turn on our mics and start talking. It becomes total chaos. But if you go down to the menu bar, on some people the menu bar is at the bottom of the screen, some people the menu bar is at the top. And you go into the chat, into the participants thing, then there's a place where you can raise your hand. This means you want to speak, which means you either want to share something, because some of you probably have great wisdom about what I've been talking about that I'd love to hear. Or some of you may have questions for me about the actual process as I just described it. So this is an opportunity for you to participate in this process. Go down to participants, click on that, and then at the bottom of that participants bar, there'll be something that says raise hand, and you click on that, and I'll see you raised your hand, and I'll ask you to say whatever it is you want to say or share whatever you want to share. On the other hand, please don't anyone feel at all obliged to participate in this way. This is totally optional. There shouldn't be any necessity that you feel to do this. On the other hand, don't all speak at once. So you've all made a resolve not to ask questions, I see. That's okay. Okay. Well, in that case, I'm going to resolve to end a little bit early, and I will finish by reading a poem. As you, any of you who know me know, I can't teach Dharma without reading some poetry. It's just part of who I am. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. It's a poem called Mysteries, Yes. And it's something we might all want to have a resolve around. I think this is what how I might describe this poem. Truly we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of lambs. How rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity, while we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or the scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. Let's just dedicate the merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for sharing the Dharma with me.